Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the widely ridiculed and patently absurd Saudi explanation for the death of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and speak with Nuket Sandal, a professor of political science and director of global studies in Ohio University Center for International Studies. She joins us to discuss her article at the Huffington Post, "Killing Jamal Khashoggi Was a Saudi Warning Shot," and whether Turkey's President Erdogan will release the recordings of Khashoggi's death on Tuesday, as promised, when he plans to announce results of the Turkish police and intelligence investigation, or will some kind of diplomatic deal involving regional stability over the future of Qatar be made and the grisly details buried. With Saudi Arabia's King Salman announcing a comprehensive Saudi inquiry headed by his son MBS, the main suspect who intelligence sources believe ordered the assassination, the findings of which will be issued in a month's time, we will assess whether Trump will succeed in making this embarrassment to his and Jared Kushner's unconditional investment in the brutal and unstable Crown Prince go away, in spite of calls by Britain, France, and Germany for a full and independent investigation. Then we will speak with Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at USC and author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. He joins us to discuss his article at Harper's Magazine, "Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War?" and whether the imbalance of power from the ruthless minority rule of the Republicans will lead to a second civil war, or is Trump's reign an interregnum in which the old white power structure is dying as a new oppositional coalition struggles to be born. Then finally, we'll examine the psychological underpinning of America's deadlocked politics with Jonathan Weiler, a professor of global studies at the University of North Carolina and co-author of a new book just out, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. He joins us to discuss the different worldviews of the fixed people on the conservative side and the fluid people on the liberal side, and how personality differences rather than ideology divide us, and how they can be decoupled from our toxic political debate. And joining us now is Nuket Sandal, who is a professor of political science at Ohio University and the director of global studies in Ohio University Center for International Studies. She's the author of Religious Leaders and Conflict Transformation and Religion and International Relations Theory. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, "Killing Jamal Khashoggi Was a Saudi Warning Shot." Welcome to Background Briefing, Nuket Sandal.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me.
So thanks for joining us, Nuket. And now President Trump has, of course, been almost coaching the Saudis to come up with an explanation for what happened to Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. After they did, finally, they had all kinds of different versions of what happened, denying it, and then recently coming up with an absurd and almost laughable explanation. There's been a subsequent explanation from another high-ranking Saudi that doesn't really answer any of the real questions. Trump is basically now saying, well, he's not entirely convinced with their explanation, but he still endorses the Crown Prince. So I guess the real question is here, the whole thing would be settled, surely, Nuket, if Erdogan would just come out with this evidence that he keeps teasing about.
Well, you have a good point there, Ian. So there are certain conversations happening definitely behind the scenes between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And Turkish officials so far have been very careful with how much information they release and when they release it. So depending on how these communications go with the Saudis, Turkey will either release more information, including what it is suspected that Turkey has the video recordings as well. Or if things go well with the Saudis, they might just not release any of those. And so far, Turkish officials actually denied having released or leaked any of these records. So only time will tell how much we will see from the Turkish side.
Now, without being too cynical, Nuket, is it possible that the Saudis could throw some money at Erdogan?
I am suspecting that it will be more than beyond money, and it will be some promise of long-term stability. Because, as you might already know, there was some turbulence around Qatar in the past, which Turkey has really strong relations with. So my expectation would be that rather than money, it would be more like we will make sure that there won't be too much of this instability in the future regarding Qatar.
Well, we know that the Turks sent a military unit down there as a tripwire,
yes,
because the Saudis could have invaded. And it's worth noting that 2 weeks after President Trump made his state visit to Saudi Arabia, which was his first state visit, the young crown prince then went ahead with this blockade that seems about as well thought through as his war in Yemen. But the real agenda there with the blockade of Qatar is they want to shut down Al Jazeera, don't they?
Well, they just want to have control of the region. Let's put it that way. It's not just about Al Jazeera. It's not just about Muslim Brotherhood. It's just they want to make sure that in the future there will not be any significant challenge to the Saudi rule, and they will be able to control what is happening, who the actors are in the region in general.
Well, I don't know that how's he going to have any credibility on the world stage? You've got the leaders of France, Germany, and the UK calling for a real inquiry. I think it probably is going to end up in the UN, don't you think?
Oh, yes. No, right now, after what happened, you are absolutely right. I think, and this is something I wrote in the Huffington Post article, they did not expect that, there would be a strong Turkish surveillance on the consulate, and the second, that this would come out this strongly and would attract so much attention. So they were wrong in those estimations for sure. And if these Saudi authorities or the crown prince could go back, I think they would have done it differently. But at the same time, in long term, it is still to be seen what the implications will be. One implication is, as you know, Ian, like recently, Mohammed bin Salman has been represented as the champion of reform in the region, in Saudi Arabia. So that perception definitely will change. After this incident, I cannot imagine any columnist, any journalist writing about MBS in the way they used to a month ago. So that will change. But what does it mean for long-term Saudi-U.S. relations or Saudi role in global politics and economy is to be seen.
And again, I'm speaking with Nuket Sandal, who's a professor of political science at Ohio University and director of global studies in Ohio University's Center for International Studies. She's the author of Religious Leaders in Conflict Transformation and Religion and International Relations Theory. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, Killing Jamal Khashoggi Was a Saudi Warning Shot. Now, the president, basically, in regard to these shifting stories on the part of the Saudis, the latest of which nobody takes seriously, the president said their stories are all over the place. But then he went on to talk about the crown prince and saying he's been a person who can keep things under check. I mean, that in a positive way. He truly loves his country. I mean, keeping things under check. I mean, this is a medieval country where they have absolute power. And
plus, Ian, that's not exactly the right comment to make, even if you want to keep things going on with Saudi Arabia, because the crown prince is actually about to make the claim that this happened outside of his knowledge, which means that he actually didn't have very good control, according to his account.
Right.
Because we have also seen 18, I think, Saudi nationals have been arrested, and two of them are very close members of the inner circle of Mohammed bin Salman. And King Salman has actually started this restructuring of Saudi intelligence, and he guaranteed that there would be a report in a month about what exactly happened. And who leads that initiative? The crown prince. So the argument is very obvious that they will make. They will try to make the argument that maybe some arguments about Jamal Khashoggi, that he was a threat. And definitely they will make the argument that this was done outside of the knowledge of the crown prince and by some circles who were close to the crown prince, which means that they will make the argument that the crown prince did not have much control over that.
But how much do you think that Salman and MBS, his son, are in an alternative universe because they have absolute power? You know, there's no parliament, there's no courts, they get the Sharia law. I mean, you know, Ambassador Jordan, Robert Jordan, who was George W. Bush's ambassador to Saudi Arabia, he was there at the time of 9/11 and afterwards, and he wasn't King Salman then, but he was, you know, the governor of the very province where most of the 15 of the 19 hijackers in 9/11 were Saudis. Most of them came from King Salman's province where MBS grew up. He was the governor. And when the Ambassador Jordan said, you know, but 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, how do you explain that? And Salman said it was a Mossad plot, that 9/11 was conducted by Israeli intelligence. So how do you deal with that kind of mentality? If the kid has the same mentality as his father, maybe that explains why he thought he could get away with this.
As I said in the article, I think they had actually a lot of reason to believe that they could get away with this. The only thing that makes this different is how it was conducted. I mean, if Khashoggi was killed in a quote-unquote accident or something else happened, then they could put a reasonable distance between themselves and what happened. But right now, of course, given that this happened in the most brutal manner, in the consulate, changes how this looks. But at the same time, they had every reason to believe that they could get away with the disappearance or the killing of a dissident. So I'm not very surprised that they actually believed that. They probably, as I said before, underestimated the extent of the surveillance. They did not think that there could be audio or video recordings of this. But the disappearance of Khashoggi, possibly his murder, if this hadn't taken place like this, would be in their interest. And when I say warning shot, what I meant in the article was that the Crown Prince wants to give a strong message to the dissidents in diaspora and the Saudi diaspora and their supporters. So in that sense, he took it very personally. And this is a very strong message, the way it is done, even if it didn't leak out in this way. It's a pretty bold message.
Well, you also point out very accurately and necessarily, Niket, that this is exactly the same MO of Putin in poisoning Litvinenko with polonium and Skripal with Novichok, sending a message to his dissidents, both at home and abroad, and Kim Jong-un using a binary form of VX nerve gas on his own half-brother, all happening on foreign soil. So there's definitely a pattern there, and I might add that all three, Putin, MBS, and Kim Jong-un, the world leaders that our president praises more often than not, and while trashing our traditional allies. So, welcome.
Yes, and I mean, I would like to also remind that when President Trump first heard about this incident, his reaction was that, well, this didn't happen in this country, and the person is not an American citizen. Khashoggi is a resident. From the first reaction, you could see that President Trump is very ready to leave this behind, regardless of its details. And then he was under pressure from his own party, from members of the Congress. So he had to say something remotely negative about what's going on. And that's why we have got the statement of all the stories all over the place. Yes, but at the same time, as you pointed out, it's always followed with an applause or with a positive comment about the Crown Prince, about the King, about how transparent this investigation is, which is very questionable, of course.
Well, the idea that they had a quarrel and then suddenly, you know, he gets his fingers chopped off and his head chopped off and...
That's not very credible.
No, but the glaring question that's left hanging is, where is the body, right? So
of course,
do you know about the searches underway in Turkey There are two versions that the body was chopped up and disposed of in the woods outside of Istanbul, or the latest one that Reuters is reporting from a senior Saudi official was that the body was rolled up in a carpet and handed off to a local Saudi or somebody that was on the Saudi payroll to be disposed of. Do you think the MIT and the Turkish investigators are going to find the body?
Well, it is too early to make any guesses at this point. It is definitely, in their explanation, Saudi's explanation, which has changed since the incident happened, there are many gaps. And this is one of the gaps. We cannot know exactly what happened. The only people who probably can make guesses are the people who have the audio and video recordings. And I think those are not very long recordings. So the Turkish intelligence agency is on it. And I don't know whether we will have any answers soon to the question of body.
Well, but Erdogan says that he's going to announce details of Turkey's investigation on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So what do you expect? I mean, you were saying earlier that it may not even come out because they may make some kind of deal for regional stability, particularly over Qatar. But on the other hand, he's, you know, been leaking this stuff profusely. I'm assuming that the MIT has pretty close relationships with the CIA. Do you think the material, even if it's not made public, has been shared with other intelligence services?
Oh, it's always a possibility. I think this is a kind of case where what we know in public is much less than what's going on behind the scenes. And everyone, including President Trump, including President Erdogan, and including the Saudis, will want to look like they're in control of the narrative. How successful they will be, we will see. At this point, I think we are basically dependent on what is going on in private chambers in terms of conversations and interests, unfortunately, rather than what really happened and who was really responsible for that.
So do you think that there's going to be any injustice here? I mean, it's a horrible thing that happened. And
It is a horrible thing. It's shocking. But given the state of global politics right now, I am almost 100% sure that there will not be justice.
Well, it's not the best note to end on, but
I'm sorry. I hope I will be able to be more optimistic in the future with our conversations, Ian.
Well, thank you, Nukhet. And again, I've been speaking with Nukhet Sandal, who's a professor of political science at Ohio University and director of Global Studies in Ohio University Center for International Studies. She is the author of Religious Leaders and Conflict Transformation and Religion and International Relations Theory. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, Killing Jamal Khashoggi Was a Saudi Warning Shot. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the imbalance of power from the ruthless minority rule of the Republicans will lead to a second civil war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And he has an article at Harper's Magazine, Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Good to be back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. And your article at lead article at the Harper's Magazine begins with a quote from Antonio Gramsci. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appears. And the morbid symptoms are pretty manifest today as we are faced with this question of whether the imbalance of power from the ruthless minority rule of the Republicans will lead to a second civil war, or is Trump's reign an interregnum in which the old white power structure is dying as a new oppositional coalition struggles to be born? That's how you begin your article. So expand on that, if you will.
Well, the basic problem is that the Senate was constructed, obviously, by the founders who came from the South and were slaveholders to give two seats to every state, no matter how many people lived in that state. But by 2040 or so, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. And that means that 30% of the voters will choose 70 of the 100 senators. And those 30% will be older, whiter, more rural, certainly not representative of the metropolitan center of the country where all the jobs and all the excitement and all the culture is being created. So what I see happening is more and more progressives getting disenfranchised, the Senate being a block on any kind of progressive legislation. And so, in fact, we have to do what California is doing, which is saying we're going to create our own ways of doing things, whether it's got to do with gun control, whether it has to do with environmental laws, whether it has to do with immigration policy, all these things. The states need to have the ability to assert their own rights to rule their own territories. And quite honestly, the 10th Amendment of the Constitution says that anything that isn't specifically given to the federal government is controlled by the states. And so what I'm arguing is that we need to reassert our 10th Amendment rights. And certainly California is leading in this charge, although many, many other states, including New York, Washington, Oregon, Vermont, others are joining us in trying to, fight Trump. Many suits against Trump by the attorney generals of many states, and it's just the beginning of a long battle.
So you also mention in your article that Trump is a transitional figure like Oliver Cromwell, and he's the Oliver Cromwell of American history. So expand on that, if you will.
Well, my sense is that, you know, as you the quote you first used, we're in what's called an interregnum. And the interregnum is a term that was used in the Cromwellian era when the old is dying, that is, Cromwell literally signed the death warrant for the king of England and chopped his head off. But Cromwell didn't represent any kind of new politics. He just was this transition figure, and eventually it wore itself out and, you know, Britain came back to a world of kind of parliamentary democracy, which was a new thing. And most of that came about because of the chaos of the Cromwell era. So I think Trump is creating a great deal of chaos, but I don't think he represents any new politics. He certainly has destroyed the classic Republican conservative politics, which used to believe in fiscal restraint, used to believe in free trade, used to believe in alliances, and he's destroyed all that. But he hasn't brought anything new to the party. And so what I'm suggesting is that when Trump is gone, Trumpism will die and we will come back to something different. But the problem is that for progressives, we still need to keep moving forward. And most of the great progressive legislation in the last 10 years, whether it has to do with gay marriage or gun control or many other things, you know, decriminalization of marijuana, have come from the states. They have not come from the federal government. And in fact, the federal government has fought them all the way along until at some point the Supreme Court either ruled in favor of the states or, you know, basically people gave up on trying to, for instance, enforce federal marijuana laws as opposed to state marijuana laws. So I do believe that Trump is a unique figure. I think he is here because of a certain kinds of things that began in 1989. I cite the beginning of what I think the current interregnum is obviously the fall of the Berlin Wall, the beginning of the World Wide Web, which was conceived in 1989, but also the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine, which meant that we could have Rush Limbaugh. If your listeners don't know, the Fairness Doctrine decreed that television and radio stations had to present both sides of an issue. And now, needless to say, once that was eliminated, you could have a Rush Limbaugh, you could have a Fox News, you could have, you know, purely partisan news environment. And then the fourth thing was this notion of reality TV, which was begun in 1989 by a show called Cops, which was the first reality show. And reality TV calls itself reality, but it has nothing to do with truth. It's just a way of constructing, you know, nobody believes that these shows like The Apprentice weren't incredibly scripted. So Trump was a unique individual who understood these new factors and was able to say, well, nothing is true and all that's necessary is to make life dramatic. You know, people who think that the White House is a complete chaotic environment don't realize that that's part of the deal. It's just like The Apprentice. Right. Who's going to get fired this week? What's happening? The notion that chaos is Trump's friend distracts people from the horrible things that are happening, and he's just playing us.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And he has a lead article at Harper's Magazine, Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War? So when you talk about California in terms of, and of course Jerry Brown is suing or this government, actually, the feds are suing Jerry Brown because he wants to maintain net neutrality. There's a whole bunch of things that you listed in terms of a kind of utopian direction that California represents. Moving into the 21st century, much of the country is going back to the, 19th or 18th century. And the recent Kavanaugh Senate hearings, as you point out, we're a window into our coming civil war in the age of Republican minority rule. It's going to get worse. But the dystopian view, from my mind, just to give an example, is that it won't be long, thanks to Brett Kavanaugh, that in the southern states, in the red states, young women who are pregnant who want an abortion will be at Greyhound bus stations trying to, scramble up enough money to go to a blue state. But there'll be Christian vigilantes at these stations, Christian, I use that word in the fundamentalist sense, checking their papers to see whether they have parental consent. That's the kind of America we're heading to, at least in the red states.
Well, look, I worry that, for years and years, progressives always thought that the federal government was the liberalizing force, whether it was the Supreme Court, Brown versus Board of Education, or whether it was a Lyndon Johnson administration in terms of putting through voting rights acts. But today, the federal government is doing exactly the opposite thing. It is doing everything it can to remove people's civil rights, to repress voter legislation, to try and put people on the Supreme Court, which will bring back, repeal Roe versus Wade. And so we have to just acknowledge the reality of it. Now, short of some kind of constitutional convention, which I do not, will never happen, we're not going to change the fact that these small states will end up dominating the Senate and the Electoral College for years to come.
And the courts.
And the courts, because obviously the Senate controls the courts. So what we have to do is try and figure out a way to live the life we want. And the difference is, and I know this sounds cynical, but in the 30s and 40s, black people used to talk about voting with their feet. And that meant they would migrate from Jim Crow South up to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, where at least they didn't have to drink out of a separate water fountain. At least they didn't have to go in the back door to separate accommodations. At least they could ride public transportation without being in the back of the bus. And it may be that for a few years, if the citizens of Mississippi who are more liberally minded may have to leave Mississippi. And if Mississippi wants to be a state where coal is the way they fuel their electrical grid and everybody has open carry, maybe that's what they're going to do. But they shouldn't have a veto on how we want to live our life in with a solar-powered, you know, gun control, you know, open, kind of free civil rights-oriented government. And so that's the only way I see it, because quite frankly, South Dakota is not going to give up its power in a constitutional convention. It's never going to say, okay, we only get one senator, you know, because we're so tiny. It's not going to happen. And so we have to just be realistic about this and try and figure out how we work this out. And obviously, there's, as I cite in the essay, there's a long Jeffersonian tradition, which, you know, is important to remember that at the beginning of the founders, the whole idea that the states had a lot of power was very important, you know? And this is the fight that I want to try to do. I mean, Jefferson said the true theory of our Constitution is that the states are independent as to everything within themselves and united as to everything respecting foreign nations. And that's the vision of a different kind of America where there's a certain amount of freedom. And to my mind, that would reduce some of the tension that is leading to this potential civil war that the Kavanaugh, you know, hearings obviously surfaced the incredible anger that's going back and forth.
Right, and you also point out in your article that in 2015, the California economy grew 4.6%, while Kansas grew by only 2.2%. So it's already happening, the change. But the fact of the matter is that as more and more Americans leave these red states, go to these metropolitan centers like in New York and in California, this dilutes their political power. We know that from the last election. Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes, but they didn't count. So when you say that people in Mississippi can just leave, well, maybe if that's the demographic shift, maybe the reverse should be true. Maybe liberals should move to these red states and try and change them.
You know, it's interesting. I heard last night someone said to me, you know, Obama's trying to convince people to move to South Dakota. You know, so, I I can understand that. It's you know, I'm not going to be a volunteer to go be a homesteader for South Dakota democracy, but, you know, maybe some people are going to do it. I think the natural tendency is that people want to move to where the creative class is living, and that's, you know, 15 or 20 big cities that where most of the jobs are. You know, when Amazon goes around and figures out where it's going to put its next headquarters, I promise you they're going to put it in a place where they're not worried that some person is going to pass a law against abortion, or where someone's going to pass a law against, you know, gay rights or transgender bathrooms. It's just not going to happen. The corporations want to be where there's a very open, diverse economy. And as we saw, you know, when North Carolina passed that bathroom bill, you know, many of the big companies just boycotted the state.
Right. And that definitely got the, definitely got their attention. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jonathan Taplin.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And he has a lead article in Harper's Magazine, Rebirth of a Nation, Can States' Rights Save Us from a Second Civil War? We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking at the underpinning of America's deadlocked politics.
We ain't going to the town.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jonathan Weiler, professor of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, Human Rights in Russia, A Darker Side of Reform. And his latest book, co-authored with Mark Hetherington, just out, is Prius or Pickup: How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
So the idea that the mess that we're in, the polarized, divided America, and it's not just a division. There's always been the duopoly, the two parties. But now it's tribal, it's nasty. And frankly, the head of the Republican Party seems to be the one that on a daily basis is stirring the pot and turning this witch's brew into a kind of hateful, constant messaging that exacerbates the divide. So did you write the book to try and heal the divide or to basically point out why it's happening?
A good question. I would say our first aim was to try to explain it, to at least try to provide historical and psychological context so that people could better understand why, when they look across the aisle at the other side, they don't just see political opponents, people they disagree with, but why, in fact, they see people who seem so alien to their fundamental way of thinking about reality that they just can't even comprehend how anybody on that side could think the way they do. So I think we did want to try to explain that, you know, as fairly and even-handedly as we could.
Well, if this were a football game or rugby or, I mean, American football, they don't line up and face each other, but just facing the opposition, you have the game, you beat the hell out of each other, somebody wins, and then you all go out and get drunk together.
Yeah. But
what we seem to have in our politics is the Republicans just want to win at all cost, and they're quite ruthless, as we saw in the recent Kavanaugh hearing. And the Democrats, you know, their own base is now furious with them for being so feckless. So is there something going on there, a difference? In other words, in a Democratic system, it's not a question of exterminating the other side and winning totally. It's a question of, you know, the pendulum swings. You win some, you lose some. Is that changed?
Yeah, so Ian, let me try to answer that two different ways. The first way I want to try to answer that is to say that sense that liberals, and I include myself in that category, have that the other side just plays by an entirely different set of rules, that they're just absolutely ruthless. I'm always struck by the degree to which conservatives say the exact same thing about liberals. Now, let me be clear, that doesn't mean that each claim is equally true. But it is notable and striking to me how much you see that from the other side. So there's a distinction I want to make between how ordinary folks think about and see reality. And again, I think that's something we really wanted to try to get to the heart of in the book. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, how political elites themselves operate. And how those political elites operate, it does seem clear to me, as it does to you, that they are playing by different sets of rules, and that one has been much more sort of instrumental and ruthless and in many ways effective at bending political reality to its will. That's the Republican Party, than have Democrats.
Well, but the rule book for democracy is the vote, right? I mean, that's always understood.
Yeah.
If you don't want the other side to vote, and if you come up with all kinds of machinations and chicanery to deny the other side the vote, it's not just unfair. It's you don't believe in democracy.
Yes, I agree. And you know, the voter suppression activities that the Republicans have engaged in with increasing ardor over the past, what's it been, 10 or 15 years now, and really intensifying more recently, what's happening in Georgia now being a particularly egregious example, are they're just reprehensible.
Well, let's talk about your new book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. And the four questions are, which qualities do you think is more important for children to have, independence or respect for elders, obedience or self-reliance, curiosity or good manners, being considerate or being well-behaved? So those are the keys to understanding the psychology behind the divide.
Yeah, that's right. And let me say a couple of things about those four pairings of attributes. The first is about the attributes themselves. So, you know, Ian, I often joke when I talk to people about this, for example, on the pairing curiosity versus good manners. I have a daughter who's now 21, and of course, when she was growing up, I very much wanted her to be curious. But, you know, when we went out to eat, I also didn't want her to be a disgusting slob. I did want her to have good manners. And I think many people look at these pairings and say, well, you know, I want both. What I think makes these questions or the way people respond to them interesting is that once you force people to make choices, well, if you had to choose, is it more important for people to be independent or respect elders, that's when things start to get really interesting politically. And it's worth noting that we've always had differences of opinion about questions like this as long as we've had survey data. What's changed and what's made the divide so distinctive is the degree to which how people answer these four questions have sorted themselves out into the Democratic and Republican parties over the past generation or so. So, you know, 30 years ago, it was as likely that Democrats as Republicans would answer these questions in what we now refer to as a more fixed direction, and the Republicans were as likely to answer these questions in a more fluid direction. And that's no longer true.
So it's the other way. It's the reverse now, isn't it? The Republicans tend to be fixed and the Democrats tend to be fluid.
Right. What I'm saying is that it used to be that you would find plenty of Republicans who are fixed and fluid, and also plenty of Democrats who are fixed and fluid. Now, as you say, Republicans are overwhelmingly fixed and Democrats are overwhelmingly fluid. And it means that our political divide is much more than differences of opinion about policy matters. The division is a much deeper, more visceral, gut level and emotional one. And it means that when we consider the other side's point of view, we're not just disagreeing about policy issues. We really can't understand how the other side views reality at all. We impute to them bad faith. We assume the worst in them. We think that they're actually enemies of our country and so forth and so on. And it's obviously not a good basis for any kind of civility itself can be wildly overrated, and some of the greatest advances in our history have happened when movements were not civil. But that our government is so dysfunctional now has in part to do with the nature of the divide we're experiencing.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Weiler, who's a professor of global studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, Human Rights in Russia, A Darker Side of Reform. And his latest book, co-authored with Mark Hetherington, just out, is Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. So along with the fixed people who tend to believe that our lives are threatened by terrorist criminals and illegal immigrants, and the priority should be to protect ourselves, and then the fluid people, it's a big, beautiful world, mostly full of good people, and we must find a way to embrace each other and not allow ourselves to become isolated. There is, of course, a third category, the mixed, who are somewhere between these two poles. And it's worth noting that the biggest political group in this country, the biggest political party, if you will, are independents. So the fact that the mixed is the biggest group, isn't that something to feel a little bit comforted by?
Well, it all depends. You know, we have a chapter in our book. We talk about the mixed in depth. And one of the things that I think we found sort of noteworthy, and I would say troubling, was that when we looked at a lot of the sort of hottest button cultural issues that we're facing today, whether about race or immigration, for example, the mixed were not like the fixed or the fluid. They really were distinct in their view, but they were closer to the fixed than they were to the fluid on a lot of these issues. There's one notable exception here, and that's gay rights, where the mixed are closer to the fluid than they are to the fixed. And I think one reason this is so significant, Ian, is that we're in a binary political system. You know, we're essentially two parties, and people are forced to make choices. And a lot of folks in the middle are making choices that they don't find particularly palatable, either as to Trump or to the other side. But when push comes to shove, many of them will find themselves less uncomfortable with the Republican view of some of these issues than the Democratic view. And I think that does help to explain why a lot of people who clearly disliked Trump nevertheless voted for him.
Well, from a journalistic point of view, the way I see it, Jonathan, is that to be a journalist, or for that matter, an intelligence officer or analyst, your job is to be skeptical. It's to question. is to eschew dogma
and
a rigidity and a fixed position. And the way I see a fixed position in terms of conservatism is also reflected in fundamentalist religion. In other words, you just have a fixed worldview that provides you with a certain predictability and comfort, whereas it's not comfortable being in the gray area because you can't continually searching. But that's the way I see it. Does that fit into your thesis?
Yeah, I think very much so. I do think it's true that, you know, the fixed in general are particularly uncomfortable with uncertainty. They do prefer things in general to be straightforward, black and white, clear cut. There's all kinds of studies that show that folks on that side of the worldview spectrum, as we call it, don't want to think too much or too deeply about complicated problems. And so I think all of those things are true of the fixed. You know, the challenge, there's two things I would say. One is under duress, many people, not just folks who are fixed, are going to default to and retreat to the kinds of attributes that I just mentioned, which is why, for example, after 9/11, George W. Bush had 90% approval ratings. You know, when people experience immediate threat, they tend to want to simplify their reality and batten down their the hatches. And that's true, I think, across the spectrum. It's just that the fixed folks, that's much more likely their sort of default and normal state than it is for others. But about the mixed, what's hard here from a political perspective is that this large group of independents also do tend to have less strong feelings about politics in general. And so they are really, rather than sort of defining their own, I don't know, more ambiguous course where they acknowledge shades of gray, et cetera, they're sort of listing back and forth between one side and the other, because they do have less strong feelings about politics in general and are persuadable by one side or the other.
Well, there is, of course, I'm sure you're aware of the work by George Lakoff.
Yes.
Where he divides it into a kind of authoritarian father versus a comforting and yielding mother. How does that fit into your mix there?
Well, I would say, you know, it fits very well. And just a note on terminology here, in our previous book, Authoritarianism and Polarization, which you and I have talked about before, we use the terms authoritarian and non-authoritarian. And obviously we changed those terms for this book. And one reason we changed those terms was not because we do say in the current book, Prius or Pickup, that folks on the fixed side are more likely, under the right circumstances, to support authoritarian leaders. But one reason we changed that terminology to fixed and fluid is that it is, again, from my point of view, unfortunately, not the case that the fixed, the folks we used to call authoritarian, is not the case that they are outliers. And I think the term authoritarian, we thought, sort of connoted that. They are quite normal insofar as many, many Americans share that perspective. So I think we just wanted to make clear how typical that worldview is. And in some ways that, you know, that makes the challenges that we're now dealing with that much greater. But without a doubt, just, Ian, to come back to your original question, there is certainly an affinity between the kinds of divisions we're talking about and those that Lakoff talked about.
Well, it is a fact that, 63 million Americans voted for Donald Trump in the last election and 66 million voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And in the real world, the person that gets the most vote wins. But we have obviously have a two elections here, one that is a relic of going back to the slave states.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you can't dismiss, if you're a liberal, you can't dismiss 63 million of your fellow citizens. And that's, there's a tendency on the liberal side to be self-righteous. They don't necessarily want to win, but they want to be righteous, whereas the Republicans want to win at all cost, and they don't seem to care too much about intellectual or even moral inconsistency. Look at what's happening now with Donald Trump and the Saudis. It's absolutely a graphic and appalling example of that.
Yes, agreed. And Ian, this point you're making is really important, and it goes back to, you know, the beginning of our conversation about one of the reasons we wrote the book. 63 million Americans is a lot of people, A. And B, if we want to win elections, our elections, as you know, Ian, they're so close now. we're such a closely divided country in so many places. We have so many races that go to recounts. And, you know, so when we're talking about that few votes potentially swinging elections and control of legislatures and control of public policy, I do think it's especially important to try to understand and appreciate, you know, where the other side is coming from. And again, I'm not talking about political elites. I'm not talking about Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan or Susan Collins or Donald Trump or any of those folks. However much contempt one wants to feel for those people, you know, God bless. But when we're talking about ordinary folks, some of whom do change their mind from one election to the next, I do think it's incredibly important, as you say, for liberals to try to be a little less self-righteous. I'm plenty guilty of that myself, and work a little bit harder to try to understand folks on the other side, even if liberals think, well, how come conservatives never try to understand us? I think there's some truth in that. It still doesn't undermine the political value, let alone the human value, of trying to at least try to make sense of where other folks are coming from.
Well, Jonathan Wyler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Wyler, who's a professor of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, Human Rights in Russia, A Darker Side of Reform. And his latest book, co-authored with Mark Hetherington, just out, is Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.